By no means were the rains of June 30th the literal beginning of the circumstances that led to the Great Flood of 93. In fact, a very wet fall of 92 and one of the wettest winters in some time, followed by a very rain-filled spring and early summer, all led to the backup of water, which became a great natural disaster. By the 181st day of 1993, June 30th, North Central Missouri had received some form of precipitation on 100 of those 181 days. More than half of the first half of this year was filled with rain, sleet, or snow. It was this relentless pattern that made it possible for the cloudburst on June 30th to spur massive flooding. And by no means was that night the worst of the rains to come. Only six nights later, Moberly received 3.5 inches of rain, while other reports topped the 4, 5, and even 6-inch mark. It quickly became apparent that anyone with farmland, property, or a business near a local river was in jeopardy. We begin on that 30th day of June when Quicksland was stunned by the onslaught of severe weather, a storm system that knocked out power here at Quicks right in the middle of continuous coverage. Eric Chisholm, Paul Lewandowski, Ken Cuyava, Brad Boyer, myself, and others worked in pitch-black conditions to keep our continuous weather coverage on the air. But the slight misfortunes we were dealing with at the studios were minuscule in comparison to the troubles North Central Missourians were facing all around the area. During our continuous coverage, Sam Snyder with the Shelbina Special Road District told us about some bridge problems.
We had some bridges that are washing out some of the bigger culverts and stuff, so I want the patrons kind of be careful around those and with this water coming over. They're kind of hard to see, so they need to kind of watch that.
Any ones in particular, Sam?
Well, I've just checked about half of them so far, and there's been about three of them that are getting pretty bad shape so far. They're out to the northwest of Shelbina and to the northeast.
Monroe City residents that same night suffered power outages, as did many Quickslanders. They also had to deal with downed trees, large limbs, collapsing barns, and more. In Moberly, A.B. Kelly Motors sustained nearly $500,000 in damage to cars during the storm. A lightning strike that same fateful night in Brookfield burned the home of Ronnie and Carol Lee Hall, who escaped with nothing more than the clothes on their back. The rains on June 30th were a marker for the beginning of 2 months of rising water, false signs of falling rivers, and eventually the daunting task of the great cleanup. By Thursday, July 1st, the National Weather Service was forecasting the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, and most of their tributaries to exceed dangerous flood levels. Life for most Midwesterners changed in a heartbeat with the onset of steady high water throughout rivers and streams. Daily travel became harder and harder for some, and almost everyone had a particular route or path they were forced to rethink because of the flooding. On July 2nd, bridges up and down the Mississippi began to close due to high water. The Highway 54 bridge at Louisiana, the Highway 36 bridge at Hannibal, and the Highway 24 bridge at Quincy all either closed or limited vehicle traffic due to high water. While travel by car was getting tougher as the flood worsened, travel by other means was at times altogether halted. Barge traffic along both the Missouri and Mississippi was stopped. It would be months before they would leave shore again. But maybe most devastating of all in travel terms was the flood's impact on the rail lines. Norfolk Southern Railroad PR manager Bob Allman spoke with the Quicks newsroom about the rail situation on July 6th.
Saturday, June 26th at 9:30 in the morning, our trackage in Hannibal has been underwater. We now estimate that our tracks are under about 5 to 6 feet of water, and of course that means we're not moving trains as we normally do from Decatur to Hannibal to Moberly. Instead, that freight traffic is being detoured by way of St. Louis.
Archer Daniels Midland Company in Illinois suffered some flooding, which added to the financial burdens of Norfolk Southern.
We have to have additional people working in the dispatching office in Decatur, and of course it's further for the trains to have to be detoured by St. Louis so that our fuel costs are certainly greater.
And while repair was on the minds of rail workers, Mother Nature had other thoughts. The torrential rains continued that July 6th afternoon, dumping unwanted rains on the Show-Me State that forced evacuations, loss of telephone service in several areas, and the first talk of possible levee breaks. Levee, a word that hadn't even been introduced to many Missourians, quickly would become a term as familiar as the rain itself. As the rivers surged toward and above their flood marks, north-central Missourians combined their powers into sandbagging efforts. In fact, on July 7th, Leroy and Jerry Femler, who farm near Salisbury, watched as the raging waters invaded their land. The Femlers called our Quicks Crest newsroom with a plea for sandbagging help to save their property. Leroy Femler told us about the response.
Tremendous. When I called in, I was hoping maybe 20, 25 people show up to help. And we must have had 200 people out here, and it's just unbelievable how many people came to help. I appreciate it from my standpoint. My brother Jerry has the corn in his bottom, and he made a statement a while ago that that many friends means more to him than his 200 acres of corn does, so he really, really appreciated it, and I do too.
And those people weren't all from Salisbury.
I think there was people out of town, and judging by, you know, how they were dressed, they weren't near all farmers. I know that. So we just had a lot of good help out here. It kind of renewed my faith in people.
Salisbury was just one of an endless number of Midwest cities and towns that were busy sandbagging and trying to cope with the previous night's rains. Columbia and Jefferson City reported July 6th and 7th rain totals of more than 7 inches, leaving streets covered by 3 to 4 feet of water and forcing several evacuations. Anywhere you could find a river, you could find someone trying to fight it back. Paul Davis with the Howard County Levee District Number 4 was one who stayed to fight. He told us about the hundreds of people who were toiling away on the Missouri River levees and those of its tributaries.
The marvelous thing is we've had great cooperation from the Boonville Correctional Center. Those gentlemen, Mike Murphy and Bill Sullivan, have sent over this period in the neighborhood of a couple of hundred inmates who have been sandbagging both here at the location. They've also been filling sandbags for us out at the prison. We haul dump trucks of sand out to the prison. They've been filling them out there. It's just been a marvelous volunteer effort, and we're most appreciative.
Despite the fantastic rains that battered Missouri in the wee hours of July 7th, most levees were still holding, and casualties were minimal. But that day did not go by without its share of near disasters. 10 people had to be rescued just south of Fulton when they were trapped in their trailer homes. 3 families were surrounded by water after a nearby creek overflowed. Firefighters came to the rescue there as they boated families and their pets to safety. By July 7th, every river city in Missouri was in danger of being flooded by the raging water. But so far, the massive flooding of cities had been limited to areas north of us, in Iowa mostly. Until, that is, the alarms sounded in Alexandria, in northeast Missouri. The town was completely evacuated that July 7th evening as water began spilling over the top of the Mississippi River town's levee. Everyone left the town that night except for a couple of men at a local tavern and another man who stayed to videotape the freak of nature from a second-story window of a house. Several other communities would follow suit as Old Franklin, Pattonsburg, and other like river communities packed up and headed for the hills. The toughest decision in that situation is whether to stay and fight what could be a futile battle or run for shelter and take with you what you can. That's the decision that thousands of Missourians faced in that early part of July 1993. The levees would not go unwatched as sandbaggers worked tirelessly day and night to shore up levees that were threatening to breach. In New Franklin, Jimmy Snoddy and the gang at Snoddy's store were preparing for a river crest of 35 feet.
Really, a lot of people getting shooken up now. They're starting to move everything out, and a lot of the farmers are, you know, they know the worst is yet to come, and it's going to be too bad for them.
You folks who live by this river, I guess you've seen this before, but this may be one of the big ones.
Yeah, in 150 years, it's going to be the biggest one yet.
The expectation became a reality. Not far away in Saline County, the levees were giving in. The National Weather Service issued flash flood warnings for the Saline County side of the Missouri River at Glasgow on the evening of July 8th when 2 breaks sent water flushing into bottomland. That same day, the city of Brunswick was having sewer trouble. The sewer system couldn't keep up with the rising water, and basements around the community were filling with sewer backup. Brunswick Mayor Carl Schubert said many people were taking refuge in the homes of neighbors. At a time when the heart of the United States of America was in its greatest distress, both President Bill Clinton and his Vice President Al Gore were working out of the country. But officials assured flood victims that the process for aid would not be slowed due to that fact. In fact, via teleconference, Gore assured Missourians that aid would be on the way within a few days. President Clinton announced from Tokyo that he was working on the situation.
We're organizing the appropriate federal agencies to ensure that they work together as a team. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is working around the clock, cooperating with each of the affected states and managing our coordinated response. FEMA personnel are in five states now, assisting state governments with preparedness and recovery efforts. And FEMA's in close coordination with other states. Where disasters are declared, FEMA will set up facilities called disaster application centers to provide a speedy and efficient one-stop process for recovery.
Unfortunately, there was a lot more damage to come before assessment and therefore aid and recovery could be taken care of. On July 9th, Senator Kit Bond joined other officials in a tour of the Glasgow area to see the flood damage. Gateway Western Railroad President Riley McCarron was the tour guide, and he recalled when water couldn't even be seen from the railroad tracks.
All this was farm fields. It's now totally inundated, and it's inundated because of a levee break up river, so actually the water level here is higher than it is in the Missouri River at this point, and that's why you get this waterfall effect going over the levee.
That Gateway Western Railroad track was at the time the last remaining direct route between St. Louis and Kansas City, according to McCarron.
We're putting plastic down alongside the right-of-way, trying, in effect, to extend the levee all the way up to the top of the rail. That will give us about a 2.5-foot raise in river elevation. Right now, the river's not projected to crest that, so we're cautiously optimistic that rail service will continue and that the railroad embankment will protect the bottom land south of the railroad in Harmony.
While some were out touring flooded areas, others were escaping from them. Boonville Cooper County emergency management officials sent out warnings to stay away from Wooldridge that July 9th evening, as an apparent break in a levee sent a surge of water into the bottom grounds there. The apparent break became several actual breaches and breaks, which would flood the Missouri River community within hours. The next day, July 10th, it was northwestern Sheraton County's turn to evacuate. The Garden of Eden levee on the Grand River at Triplett broke the night before, sending water over acres of farmland. Triplett area farmer Clem Schluter said once the water topped the levee, it didn't take long to fill up the bottom ground.
About 7:20, it blew out on the northwest corner, and in about a minute and a half, it had about 240 acres covered.
And the flooding there was certainly not limited to the area immediately around the Garden of Eden levee.
The upper section broke yesterday morning. It filled up, and now at Dean Lake, it's coming over the top of the railroad track, and it's going over behind my house and jumping that ridge and coming down through Salt Creek. Triplett is going to get flooded. I'm not sure my house is high enough. And it is a mess. I mean, there's nobody knows what this sucker's done.
July 10th was also the date of another tragic flood disaster. A Boone County man died when floodwaters swept him away from friends. 36-year-old Glenn Leeton was reportedly wading through floodwaters along Route K near McBain when his friends say he stepped off the road into about 7 feet of water. The raging floodwaters swept him under, and his body was later found about 80 to 100 yards from the water's edge. Bad news only got worse when the National Weather Service issued a deadly forecast calling for more heavy rain for the weekend. And after the weekend rains, Hurricane Calvin was expected to have enough of an effect to send weekday rains toward the Midwest as well. What had become the worst natural disaster in Midwest history was only getting worse. Governor Mel Carnahan cut a summer vacation in Rome short to return to his homeland. During a time when every bit of news seemed darker than the last, there was one spark of hope. The president announced July 10th, just before a helicopter tour of Osage, Gasconade, and Callaway counties in Missouri, that 49 flood-ravaged counties had been declared disaster areas in the Show Me State, clearing the way for faster federal aid. Governor Carnahan requested immediately that the other 44 counties and St. Louis be added to that list. And by the end of the day, federal officials had complied. Farmers were certainly among the hardest hit by the floodwaters, and while the 1993 crop was quickly becoming seaweed, even more devastating problems arose. Stored grain from 1992 was in danger, and in some areas, already lost. After only a third of July had become history, 11 deaths had been attributed to the flood. The damage estimates around Missouri already reached the $1 billion mark, and crop losses were estimated in the tens of millions. More than 14,000 people statewide had been asked to evacuate their homes and towns, and 125 levees along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers had been breached or broken. The direct threat of raging floodwater is obvious. Uninhabitable buildings, threat of electrocution, drowning, and loss of property are among the fears and the consequences. But perhaps even worse, the spread of contamination and disease. Every sandbagger, flood victim, and emergency official in the state was urged to get diphtheria and tetanus shots. No longer was river current the only danger that existed in the massive floodwaters. Within a very short time, nearly every river community had some sort of vaccination shop set up for free injections. This was only a third of the way through July, and this was only the beginning of the flood of 1993.